Welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Gavin Kearney about the state of the modern art and the hijacking of the rebellious spirit and the connection with the degeneration that we see within culture and the focus on, well, death, I would say, pretty much at this stage. I wanted to get closer into what modern art really is, let's say, for those who haven't, you know, studied it and what it came out of and how we've seen that it has been modified throughout the years and ultimately, I guess, where it's going. But what is modern art, Gavin?
Well, essentially, the basic narrative runs that modern art came out of, it was a necessary result of the fundamental changes that Western civilization underwent through the scientific process, where the notion of a God-centered universe was called into question. The political upheavals in the eras of revolutions, with so-called revolutionaries overturning monarchies, but also with the breakdown of empires and the rise of nationalism.
Let me pause you there. Hold that thought. But why do you say so-called revolutionaries? I'm interested in that.
Well, like I'd say, for example, that the French Revolution, I don't actually think that whatever about the intention, the way these things started, I don't believe for one moment these were about, or certainly they didn't end up being in the interest of the people. The same with the Soviet revolutions. I mean, like, say, any of the decent ones would have been killed off very, very quickly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the model that we're given in kind of the common historic reading is, well, flawed to say the least. But I would say it's more misinformation. Does that make sense?
Oh, definitely, exactly. That's been my point as well. It's been what we've seen is consolidation of power. We've seen fewer. Hands in terms of the power grip when it comes to royalty, etc. We have there's been so many flaws in that viewpoint from the point of view of historical outlook. And I've always went back to the detailed work of Fire in the Minds of Men, for example, to see how the revolutionary movements themselves have been hijacked and how they've been used to propel us forward into a greater totalitarian state. You know, so yeah, I'm with you there. Yeah.
And I mean, we see it even nowadays with the infiltration of Occupy groups and things like that.
Sure.
By essentially the controlling elites, you know, with disguises, under a different guise.
Exactly.
With the development of modern art as well, there was another aspect would have been the Industrial Revolution, and with that, the swelling of cities and mass migrations from agrarian village life towards essentially moving away from long-held folk traditions into a more kind of mutable city life. So these three fundamental changes, this is the way the general narrative goes on the emergence of modern art, that the long-held kind of lifestyle and way of viewing the world was called into question, and that the artists were then compelled to reflect these changes and the uncertainties of the age. Now, there's a lot of truth in that because art doesn't exist in a vacuum. But at the same time, it's a lot more complex and a lot more nuanced than that. Now, we tend to get just kind of one view of the development of modern art, like say that there's, in terms of visual art, it follows a line, the realist line, say, from impressionists through then to the expressionists and then towards abstraction and things like that. But in the development of modern art, there was a movement called symbolism that was central in the establishment of the new languages and the new ways of viewing things and doing things. But symbolism has, by and large, been overlooked or diminished in importance. Many of the key figures of early modern art were symbolists, or they would have been like Pablo Picasso, started as a symbolist. If you look at, say, for example, Picasso's Blue Period paintings and the Rose Period, all those paintings of harlequins and circus people and what have you, it's a symbolism. But something happened, I think, particularly following the First World War, symbolism came under a lot of attack, and did many of the key early figures of modern art. Now, the symbolists they were quite interesting in that there was still very much a primacy on the content of the work of art as opposed to the context. Stéphane Mallarmé, the French poet, said, for example, a poem doesn't consist of ideas, it consists of words. That is, it doesn't, you know, what you're saying, your intention, the context, is still secondary to the content, the actual work itself, how you do it, how you create it. And what's interesting about the symbolists as well is they tend not to be tied to a particular style in the way, say, you know, a cubist is recognizable as a cubist, or, you know, an abstract expressionist is recognizable as an abstract expressionist. Symbolism is more nebulous. It's more a way of viewing things and a more a way of seeing things. And a more, as well, I think the symbolists were a kind of a last kind of majestic attempt to reinstate a spiritualized view of art, because this was one of the things that that was being called into question, I think, probably through the process of science, that dealing with the specifics of reality. It seemed to be divesting the universe and the world of its mystery. So the symbolists would have been very, very much attracted to mythology, for example, using mythical themes and classical themes as a way of putting forth a novel idea.
Maybe that the move away from, because as you say, it's very interesting how it seems to coincide with when the majority of mankind moves into, you know, the cities. We have the rise of industrialism. That's, you know, and during the same time, of course, you have, you know, what I call, you know, cogwheel socialism, which is, you know, the focus on the mechanical and the machine. You know, it's about the industry and everything else. So you get a rise of that at the same time. You have another kind of art. But it's ultimately, to me, the move away from natural elements, from a time and an era when we had, you know, our wallpaper had a floral texture to it. Our furniture had the cabriole legs, you know, with the claws and the foot designs on them. It's like it was an idea that we're in an environment which still very much, although it's artificial, it at least mimics the natural world. But today what do we have today? Boxes, cuboids, cold sterile. We have that IKEA marriage of the socialist corporatist kind of style, which I hate. I absolutely
You're
loathe
not the
it,
only
you know.
One. Well, I mean, Oscar Wilde would probably have been in agreement with us. One of he gave this lecture, The House Beautiful. I mean, he believed, for example, that everything should be beautiful, and everything could be beautiful, and there's absolutely no reason why things should be beautiful. But of course, it is very interesting, the rise of industrialization and kind of mechanized art forms and art forms that mirrored that. I mean, it's quite telling, actually, if you look at some of the early modernists and how they were kind of attacked, particularly following the First World War. There's one who springs to mind, the Russian composer Alexander Scriabin, who died in 1915. He was only in his early 40s. But he was, at the time of his death, considered one of the most important composers in Russia. Now, of course, after he died, the Stalinist model kind of took over, and his music was absolutely out. You see, because Scriabin was influenced by Theosophy, and his music was very, very mystical and was very, very much about transcendence. And he, at the time of his death, he was planning this ritualistic piece of music that would take place in the Himalayas and that would lead to an enlightened state of being. And that was very, very much ridiculed following the First World War, following the kind of rise of a very cynical, mocking aesthetic. You had, like, say, this remember as well as the time, the emergence of, say, Dadaism, and the rise of what was called, the ironic neoclassicism in France, where you had people like Jan Cocteau essentially kind of like poking fun at a lot of the traditions, a lot of the very, very beautiful traditional art forms.
Yeah.
Like there was some snide comments Cocteau made about, kind of, I think it was Cocteau, I'm not entirely sure, it could have been Cocteau, made some snide reference to no more music about moons descending on sunken cathedrals, which is a snide mocking reference to two piano preludes by Claude Debussy.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, we can see this in modern architecture as well. We have the projects of the 60s and 70s, as opposed to when you had a past when where each building was built with veneration and a long-term idea, so it should have natural elements to it. What happened? How did we end up like this? And why is this not changing? I mean, we're still in that world today, you know?
Well, it's not changing despite nobody actually wanting it. I mean, nobody wants to live in these modern abominations, these steel glass monstrosities. But I mean, something that you do notice, like again, going back to when I was in art school, is the attack on beauty.
Yeah.
There's an absolute, because in many ways, you see, it's far more risky to create something beautiful because people can dismiss it very easily. It's far easier to create something ugly because you're not actually putting your heart on the line. Yeah. So it's in I actually consider it quite cowardly. It's very very it's very very easy to do the nihilistic ugly thing because there isn't as much of a risk of your feelings, your soul being rejected with it.
Right. Yeah.
You know. But this is the interesting thing, you see, because who actually wants this? Who wants this ugly art in public spaces? I mean, I think that's quite sinister as well. I think it's designed to make the human experience more mechanical and more ugly. I mean, as well, if you look at, like, say, some of the art movements, I mentioned the Russian composer Alexander Scriabin, and one of the reasons he was dismissed was because, you know, I think it was called constructivism, that art movement in Russia, which is everything about the glorious mechanized future. And if you look at socialist realist art, you know, of the heroic muscular workers, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Ballet is about sort of, like, you know,
a proud brawn. You know, proud brawn throwing the seeds in the grass, you know, or in the
dirt. There was one in Maoist China, the East's Awake, and you had like kind of like sort of ballet. You know, they're like prancing around, supposedly sowing seeds.
Yeah, you have a sweaty, muscular man pulling the lever in front of a cog, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you see, because it is essentially to venerate the mechanical. And men essentially as being another cog in a perfect machine,
right?
You know, because that's just the individual. The individual is obliterated. You see,
this
is also why in 1984, Orwell wrote about the party making glorious pronouncements on the abolition of the orgasm, because that would the orgasm would imply kind of like a very very personal experience, getting rid of the very very personal experience. Which, of course, now it's interesting because we live in a kind of a hyper-sexualized world, but
exactly.
That's all about gratification rather than kind of two people being in love and what have you.
Today it seems to be the flip side, and it's the demystification of sex, making it a commodity of sorts today, right?
Yeah. That's right, yeah. But also, you see, divesting it of its beauty and of its mystery.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
Another reason as well, you see, why the symbolist movement, which, again, I would consider central and key in the development of modern art, one of the reasons why that was attacked is you would find a lot of symbolist art would take mythological themes as its subject. Like, say, I mentioned Mallarmé, and Mallarmé wrote this poem, The Afternoon of the Faun, and Debussy wrote this beautiful orchestral kind of interpretation or is a piece of music inspired by Mallarmé's poem. Now, the faun represents pure eros. The faun is a sexual being. But the poem doesn't mention the faun's sexuality at all, but it's suggested. You see, Mallarmé said, to name an object is to suppress three-quarters of the enjoyment. Suggestion is the dream. Now, what happens with suggestion in a work of art is that it invites, if I suggest something to you, if I play you a piece of music, it invites your associations, your memory. You're invited into the work of art. You're invited to respond to it. You're invited as well to recognize part of yourself within it. Now, if I play you some kind of like, I don't know, some sort of constructivist piece, or for example, if I give you a conceptual work of art where the art itself is negligible, that's nothing, but it's all about the concept. It's all about what it says. That doesn't actually allow you the room to engage with it, to actually experience yourself through it, if you know what I mean. You're not allowed the opportunity to recognize the mysterious and nebulous parts of your internal landscape, which is what the symbolists were very, very much about, which is why, as well, they were kind of like mocked and kind of dismissed by particularly by many modernists after the First World War.
So they've turned it into an external thing, because today we need definitions of what it is, what does it mean, in what context is it, because otherwise people stand and like, all right, it's a block of, you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. It can be these like ridiculous things that are praised, you know, in the press and by other artists and stuff like that. And you're like, what is it really? I don't get anything from it, but you have to read and define so that you understand what it is, right?
That's it. And you see, this is fundamentally different to the work of the symbolists, because the symbolists might have a theme, it might have a subject. But the subject, as I said, there was that quote from what Mallarmé said, that a poem consists of words, not ideas. That is, the primacy of like the work of art is the components that make it up. The primacy of a piece of music are the notes. The primacy of the painting is the actual painting itself. And what happened following the First World War particularly was content, the actual work of art, was replaced by context, what we say the work of art is about. You know, so really, it doesn't really matter what kind of, eventually, what you actually do, provided you say it's about something, you know? And I mean, what this actually does, this isn't purely, though there is a lot of kind of like scope for charlatans and hucksters and shysters, basically pretenders with no talent to forward themselves. But it's not just about that, because as I mentioned in the first half, contemporary art doesn't, and the kind of the ugly contemporary art we're talking about, it doesn't sit alongside traditional art. It seeks to replace it. It seeks to annihilate it. Because so much of, like, say, the art following the First World War had very, very much this mocking, snide... it was very, very much about... Think of Dada, for example, where everything is about ridicule.
Yeah.
Everything is about mockery. And what this does is it degrades the higher values of humanity. Because, and also, so there's no commitment to it. You're not making an emotional commitment to it. You're standing there snidely outside of it, mocking it. You're not invited into it. You're not giving a person something that they can involve themselves in. But because after all, it's far easier to mock something than to create something. It's far easier to destroy something than to build something.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly.
Very, very much the onus. That's been the onus of, I would say, 60 to 65% of art since 1918.
What do you think happened during the rise of Nazi Germany and the reaction to that after the defeat of Germany? Because as we know as well, those who have been prosecuted are of course consequently lifted up and venerated as champions afterwards. We tend to move towards a defining opposite as quickly as possible from those we do not agree with as a form of rebellion. So what happened during that time and afterwards, do you think?
Are you talking about, say, the during the rise of the Nazis?
I'm thinking about the suppression of art and certain artists that they did, that they performed during their time.
Well, you see, because they were largely kind of knocking a lot of the expressionists, and a lot of they were knocking a lot of the art that I would consider quite ugly and mocking, but at the same time, They were replacing it with essentially something that to me looked very, very similar to socialist realism, this kind of these idealized sort of like statuesque figures, a kind of a fake classicism.
Well, they were socialists after all, so it makes sense.
Absolutely. Well, there you go. Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, also as well, it's worth bearing in mind like that they co-opted a lot of currents that were quite latent in German culture following, certainly I think following the operas of Richard Wagner.
Yeah, exactly.
That is the mythology, an interest in nature and naturism and vegetarianism. I mean, it's very interesting because, I mean, I'm a vegetarian, and I don't know how many times I hear from people, oh, Hitler was a vegetarian, as if that makes us, you know, a bad thing. He also liked mountains. Does that make mountains are horrible? He liked dogs, too, apparently.
I love when people do that, like, simple, I know, connections like
but,
that.
Yeah, this is it, you know, but, I mean, actually, as an aside, he wasn't a vegetarian. That was just part of his myth.
The cabbage didn't go down well in those bunkers, you know. I'm just kidding.
But I mean, their version was. I mean, their version to me was exactly the same as the socialist realist version in the Soviet Union at the time. That is this kind of ugly propaganda, essentially, where everything was about the external world. Everything is about the veneration of the state.
Yeah,
the state, the ideal, rather than the individual and the individual's interaction and the mysterious, nebulous inner world. You see, I'm very, very suspicious of ostentatious art, because I think temperamentally, naturally, I kind of resonate to. In case it didn't come across already, I resonate very much to the symbolists. I resonate very much to art that's suggested.
I do that too, because again, it's the idea that it invites you in. It becomes an internal or a personal experience, as opposed to something that just like, nope, this is what it is, that's it, kind of thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, but I mean, I'm very, very dubious about any kind of state-organized art movement. But it's interesting now, that because what we've got to bear in mind is that the contemporary, you know, all this, the stuff of like sort of crucifixes in tea and cans of crap and lights going off, that's the establishment. That's the establishment art now. The most rebellious thing you can do as an artist nowadays is to draw properly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because that's the mainstream. You know, they'd be under no illusion. You see, that they will claim that they're kind of like on the edge and stuff like that. No. Well, they might be on the edge, but they're on the edge of a precipice and they're dragging us all over it. You know, that's an edge that one doesn't really, really want to be on. But this is very, very much the art of the ruling elite. And again, there's a kind of a rottenness in it that I would equate to the kind of the abominations of the Neroan or the Caligulan age in ancient Rome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, people talk about, you know, depopulation, conspiracies involving making human beings more sick, education, all of these things together. And then if you look at art, of where it's been going and where the progression has been, it kind of plays into that whole picture, doesn't it, in a way?
Definitely. You see, because if people aspire to nothing, if you aspire to nothing, and that is, if your image of the human condition is the lowest possible, there really isn't that much point in sticking around. So that when you see kind of like, say, like footage of children starving somewhere, rather than thinking, this is horrible, I want to change this, you think, well, you know, maybe they're better off out of it. This world is a horrible, cruel, evil, twisted place. You see, that whole, there is an agenda, very, very definitely, to get people to see this world as being ugly, to see human nature as being debased and pointless and revolting. Whereas to me, to be honest with you, I think most of the evidence on a day-to-day basis points against that. In the face of everything, and think of it from basically from the age of four, we're conditioned into being in competition with each other. We're conditioned into thinking that we're only of value if we're validated by success, the outward. And yet, despite all of that, people are consistently compassionate. People consistently try to do good for people with no self-interest. Because I think that our human nature is fundamentally, it's majorly good.
Yeah.
I think that our need for beauty is innate. Our need for art and beauty is innate. This is the fact that, I mean, you know, you have ludicrous things now. Like there was an exhibition, I think it was about a year ago, an exhibition in London of Impressionists. And it was something like they were trying to put some dark kind of like swing in it, like the rebellion of the night or the revenge of the night or something. You know, it isn't enough for these guys to just paint beautiful pictures. It has to be in some way in conflict. It has to be kind of troubled and dark ugly, you know, because that's the real experience. And this is something as well that it's been very, very much conditioned into us, this view that the deeper experience, the real experience, is the very dark one, the very painful one. Now, that's part of human nature. The tragic and the painful is part of our experience, and it does crowd for a representation in art and in culture. But it means that we kind of overlook all the joyous things. We think that they're somehow that they're not as valid. And to me, the whole kind of like the onus on nihilism in popular culture, the onus, and also in high art, and to me it's the flip side of sentimentality. Now, Oscar Wilde said that, I think he said sentimentality was having an emotion without paying for it. So I feel like having a weep, so I put on a weepy piece of music and I weep, and then I switch it off.
Yeah.
So I've had the emotion, I haven't paid for it. The same applies for nihilism and like kind of like say this move towards like, you know, making very, very dark art without the consequence of what you're actually creating, because we are creating this reality as we're living it. You know, it's a way of actually having a kind of an experience of something. It's like kind of watching a horrible movie or actually, you know, watching really, really ugly, horrible things and getting a buzz from it, but without actually having to live through those experiences and come out the other side of it.
Yeah.
It's like sentimentality. It's utterly, it's fake. It's superficial.
It's, you know, some have said that the smaller the cage, the louder, and someone said the more beautiful the bird sings. And I think about the connection to art in this case as well, because you have that scenario where the, you know, the rich manager or whatever keeps the artists, starving to draw something dark and what they consider to be authentic out of them. You know, you have these, kind of champagne socialists going to their, vernissage and looking at these paintings and just kind of trying to immerse themselves in some kind of darkness and look upon these artists as some kind of, museum exhibit in themselves, right? It's that type of relationship that is occurring right now.
That's it. You see, it's essentially fake. See, this is the problem I have with it, with that whole approach. But also, as well, there's a kind of a voyeuristic, almost pornographic aspect to it, which is quite disturbing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what you were saying there, is it?
Yeah, exactly. It's the darkness is the only thing that they consider to be authentic, because it's got to be the only way that they actually feel something with, right?
Yeah.
That's the connection on the emotional level that they can have. So the darker and uglier and more, cruel, if you will, the art is, the more they enjoy it or like it.
Yes, yeah, this is it. I mean, I've long had kind of knocking around in my head. I've long been thinking about the immense posthumous fame of Vincent van Gogh. Now, everyone's heard of Vincent van Gogh, and everyone's heard of Vincent van Gogh's story. You know, and I wonder, well, why is it that everyone's heard of Van Gogh, say, and not his contemporaries? I do think he was a really, really great painter. I think he was very, very talented. He wasn't this kind of hysterical madman flinging paint around as people like to kind of like portray him as. And his life was very, very tragic. But at the same time, the majority of his paintings, he was striving towards capturing the beauty of nature and of light and of life. But that's largely overlooked. And I feel that Van Gogh has particularly been used in this process to, one, create a notion that the world is a cruel and brutal place, and that if you're sensitive, you will be destroyed. And secondly, that he was a great artist because he suffered and had to commit suicide, not because he was a great artist.
Yeah.
You know? So that's all right. So as long as I whine and scream and, as long as I make ugly stuff and like show pain, that makes me poetic. That makes my expression more authentic. It's because you see, the thing is, like, you know, with the kind of like, say, the art that's championed, it's seldom cheerful. It seldom makes you feel good about being alive. You know, it's very, very much designed to celebrate the ugliness, the sad and tragic and horrible side of life. You know, and like I said, you know, that there is definitely a place for tragedy in art. It's necessary because it's part of the human condition.
Yeah.
But what I'm talking about is the idea that it's a shortcut to profundity. It's a shortcut to depth. That, you know, so it's like, you know, if you impress upon people that, you know, if you impress upon people that you're suffering, it makes it more real. Look, if you're suffering, it's because you're human, and that, you know, that's part of being alive. That's what that is. It doesn't necessarily mean that what you have to offer is more important, because ultimately, I mean, there's something that nothing Oscar Wilde said, to conceal the artist and reveal art is art's aim. Essentially, that the artist is a conduit through which universal truths pass, and the artist, you know, has, like, say, the skill and the capability of giving it form and giving it something that's recognizable. But the artist's personality is entirely secondary. In fact, the artist's personality gets in the way of the expression of this, these universal truths and beauty. Because after all, most people, there are great universal experiences that we'll all have, you know, like love, bereavement, hope, loss, death.
Yeah.
You know? And that these have been the kind of, like, say, these were the traditional standards in art throughout the ages. You know, that there's a reason for that. I mean, there's something as well that I think about, like, something like that I came up against in university, like, tutors might say, well, you know, we are where we are. You can't like kind of go back to the way things are. And I'm saying, well, look, I'm not talking about going back to the way things were. At what point do you say, hang on, this is a mess and it's going nowhere?
Yeah.
Because also, they might have, say, the last 90 odd years of Western art on their side. I would consider I have art, not just European Western art, but all indigenous tribal folk art as well on my side. Because the fundamental driving things of, like, say, for example, visual art is by and large, it's intrinsically connected to the world we see. It's intrinsically connected to the visual faculty. So if you think of, like, say, you know, like Viking carvings, or the Book of Kells, or Native American totem poles, or, you know, West African masks and things like that, they're very, very abstract, but they're nonetheless, they're very much based on things, animals, and things that you see in the visual world. And Western art as well always had a certain amount of the abstract to it. If you think of, like, say, Renaissance paintings, they're not recording what they see. They're recording something that they're imagining.
Yeah.
You know, but what you have is this beautiful alchemical process, the mixture of the imagined with what is recognizable. And this was essentially the fundamental requirement with art, all art throughout the world up until the early 20th century. You know, and again, going back to, you know, what I was saying about, like, you know, the whole approach of, say, the postmodernists and the Frankfurt School, that they would have it that, you know, all these, you know, these great dead artists were mistaken, you know, wasting their time messing about with paint, you know, when they could have just been, you know, putting, you know, glasses of water on shelves and writing about them.
Oh, boy. Yeah. What do you think about, you know, public installations, art on squares and stuff like that? This has also been a field that has become increasingly bizarre. Sometimes when I look at some of this, I'd extend it to say, call it, you know, satanic. It's very bizarre. I mean, one clear example that I think people will recall more recently is the one at the Watford Hotel where the Bilderberg meeting now in 2013 were held. And you have this pond. I don't know if you saw this, Gavin, but there's a pond there with a woman basically looking like she's kind of crawling out of it. And you can see that it looks like the flesh is like melting off her bones. You can see half skeleton and half, like, you know, muscle tissue on the arm and stuff like that. And you see the spine is exposed and open, and it looks really, really creepy.
Well, again, I think it's to essentially create an air of ugliness to remind us that we're just these animals. We're just flesh. There's nothing else that. And I'm saying that I don't. I think that animals are beautiful spiritual beings as well. But I think that the idea behind this is that we're mere morphology. We're just this visceral, ugly stuff that's just here for a while, and it's all essentially pointless. But I mean, it's just to create further ugliness. It's the equivalent, actually, of just, you know, making a very, very loud, horrible noise in a public place.
You know? Yeah, and it's always also scream the most that people look at, right?
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Do you have any other examples of art that you've seen, like, around in England or Ireland, where you've seen all of a sudden, because sometimes they're interesting because they tie in, you know, musical instruments in some cases, or tones or notes, or, you know, things that literally send out a vibration or resonates in some way, you know, as wind blows through it. And there's a number of these examples. I can link to some of these for people who want to find out more about that. But
yeah.
Have you found any other ones that you really have questioned of what the purpose of these installations are?
Well, I mean, I don't, to be honest with you, because to be really at this stage of the game, Henrik, I just think, well, it's either for or against.
Right.
It's either for humanity or against humanity.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to, I think, well, okay, I can see exactly what they're doing. You see, there's a problem here, you see, with getting too caught up with their games. There's a problem with getting too, by all means, be vigilant and be aware of these things. But I mean, a little bit like we were talking about, like, kind of like, say, Lady Gaga and this knowing use of symbolism. I don't really, really want to have a conversation with them.
Sure.
Because I know what the end result is, essentially. I think that I see that it's either for or against, and I say, okay, I'm zoning that out.
Yeah.
You know, what we can do about it as people, I don't know. I don't know, but I don't think that people actually want this stuff. But it's very, very difficult to see, because where do you go? How do you complain about it? And also, as well, we're so sort of brainwashed into a notion of consensus, of not sticking out, of not being kind of one of the things, I think, that one of the reasons, or one of the ways that we're really controlled we're reluctant to criticize for a variety of reasons. Like if you're I'm an artist, and I'm reluctant to criticize because I can very, very easily be accused of venting sour grapes.
Mm, yeah.
Or you're just resentful because they're successful,
right,
you know?
Right.
So you say, well, okay, maybe I shouldn't say anything because people might say I'm resentful. Well, no, I will say it because it has to be said, you know? But also, people are very, very concerned with one of the successes, I think, that this very, very ugly art has, is it plays upon people's fear of appearing kind of parochial and local. You see, we all like to think that we're sophisticated and urbane and unshockable. So people are very, very reluctant to criticize not just ugly art, but ugly culture, where you have a kind of a near pornographic culture. What do? You criticize it, or you're a prude then, or you're shocked. So what actually happens is people pretend that they're not shocked, that they're not offended, because they don't want to be seen to be prudes. Because in this world, in this kind of like fake kind of adolescent nightmare world, there is only cool and square. So if you're cool, you don't criticize anything because you're above it. I'm too cool to criticize it. And you know what? That's fine for you, but unfortunately we're in a world full of people and this affects them, and it's particularly children and young adults don't have an alternative culture to compare it to. So it's therefore we have a duty to actually stand up and say, well, you know, balls to cool, this has to be said.
Yeah.
But it plays upon people's insecurity and their people's, you know, it's, I think that so much of this plays upon vanity as well, because these kind of like, these ugly sculptures or the kind of like, say, the whole kind of bricks on the floor, lights going on and off, you can walk around looking at this stuff and it doesn't make any demands on your attention. You know, you can walk around and say, yeah, that's very interesting, but it doesn't ask anything of you. It's not like, say, reading one of James Joyce's late novels or something like that, which makes intense demands on your attention. But arguably, you get something out of it because it's full of content. Or at least I would say that. I believe it is. You know, so I think that a lot of this contemporary art plays upon people's vanity. People want to be able to think that they're sophisticated and aesthetically informed without making any effort themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same applies with music. You see, it's this very, very strange thing, really, because music is the only art form that's entirely abstract. With the exception of birdsong, music doesn't exist in nature. Now, I mentioned before, like, say, visual art in some way related to the world that we see. Literature, poetry, fiction all relate to language. They all relate to the communicating faculties. Music alone is the only art form where you can actually do anything. But most music that's made and most music that's listened to is, well, to call it rudimentary is the understatement of the century. Most music that's made and most music that's listened to doesn't go much further beyond three blind mice. Yeah? And what we have is a cultural atrophy. You know, the equivalent would be adults kind of like sort of reading, you know, books for toddlers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I know that you have people say, oh, you're an elitist and stuff. Well, I'm sorry, well, so be it. You know, because, you know, well, or pardon me if I don't get excited by something that just reminds me of 1,000 other things. And again, I know that this is, I'm in risky territory saying that myself as a musician, because I'm laying myself bare to be judged along the same very, very rigorous standards, but that's all right, judge away, because that's part of the risk you take if you're an artist.
Yeah.
You are going to be judged.
Yeah, it's interesting times. We have so many issues as well, and one thing that's concerned me is how quickly we believe that we can transform and change not only ourselves but also our society with the delusion that today's media primarily, but also to a certain extent, some of the scientists have been trying to argue, despite some science speaking in contradictory terms. But I'm talking about we're in a world now where children, for example, are taught that the only difference between men and women are it's just social constructs. They're ignoring all the hundreds of thousands of years of the roles that we've held, the physical differences, and never mind the studies in neurology that shows that men and women are completely wired in different ways for different purposes, which is a good thing, you know. But we're looking at history, we're looking at everything that we've gone through collectively as a human race, the species. with our current very, very skewed moral lens and propagandized lens.
Yeah, that's right.
And we're trying to change. I can see it in the movies and the TV shows that are literally trying to speak about history and at the same time change it to make it fit into our own worldview of how we judge things by today. It's very dangerous, I think, to do that, actually.
Oh, absolutely. And again, this is another thing where, I mean, Orwell writing about it in 1984, where they would go past, they would go through the old newspapers and modify them.
Exactly.
You know, just to fit the current kind of standard. I mean, this is a very, very dangerous thing, because we're imposing our own standards and our own kind of experiences and claiming that this is how it's always been. But it hasn't always been this way. Like, say, for example, people say about, like, say, the kind of ugliness and nihilism in contemporary culture. They say, well, you know, it's always been like that. No, it hasn't always been like that. It's at a kind of a nadir. No, it was like that in other periods of history. Again, I'd say kind of towards the fall of Rome. That was, you know, we were in this kind of territory. You know, in many ways, regarding the whole kind of, like, say, focus on, say, gender roles and things like that, I wouldn't mind so much if it was even. I wouldn't mind so much if there was still some platform for kind of like the more traditional sort of, like, say, family setup and stuff like that. But when you have kind of like soap operas and films where the kind of, like, you know, kind of a husband and wife, they're the dysfunctional relationship. You know, that's something that I, like, if I very occasionally out of masochistic curiosity, I'll watch a soap opera, and you'll see that the kind of, like, the healthy relationships with children are when they're not their own children or something like that. You know, it's absolute brainwashing. But again, it's a question of just being aware that we are being modified. Everything that's in the public domain on a large scale, it's there to redesign us in some way. As long as we're aware of that, we can filter it out. But it means that we, in my case, you just don't watch TV, don't listen to the radio anymore, because you see the signs and you say, okay, I don't want to. And you see, nobody is immune to that. Nobody is immune to that, because even if there are things you know you're being played, it's very, very easy to be seduced by the drama that's being played
out. You're right.
And also, we internalize this stuff subconsciously. That's also why, as well, like, I don't waste my consciousness and my attention on the ugly stuff, because you can't get that stuff out of your head. You can't unsee it. There are things that I've seen I wish I could unsee. I wish I could see the sadness thing, but I can't.
Well, we'll get into that, you know, again, the mind wipe, right? You can just take a pill or, you know, remove traumatic experience. They're doing that now, by the way, with the post-traumatic stress. DARPA is doing some research in removing, you know, memories like that. That's also, you know, that's talk about 1984, right? So
absolutely. I know, exactly. I know. But the thing is, as well, you see, it's like, there's a reason why we have the memory faculty.
Exactly.
You know, we're not supposed to unremember things. You know, we're supposed to, you know, keep them there. They're to kind of, so we have a sense of what's actually going on and who we are, where we're coming from. But we're in a world where kind of grief, now people suffering from grief are being kind of, like, you know, classified as some suffering from grief disorder. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's grief. That's what it is. You know, where most children, they have energy because they're children, and they're classified as having attention deficit disorder. And who wouldn't have attention deficit disorder being stuck on a kind of a lovely sunny day in some dreadful room with some completely pointless, ridiculous nonsense being shoved into their heads that they'll forget instantly?
Yeah.
You know, of course they're going to have attention deficit disorder. You know, I don't remember anything from, like, 16 or 17 years in school. You know, my, because I three older siblings, and I could read and write when I went to school. So I didn't actually learn anything in school. Or the stuff I did learn, I wish I could unlearn, you know?
Yeah.
But spend the rest of my life unlearning it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's true. And, you know, everything has been psychologized, social engineering. Yeah. It's, you know, completely surrounds us. And then when you think you might want to, and, you know, entertain yourself, go to some of the areas where you want to kind of get your mind off things and decompress, you know, like art, like movies and entertainment. There is where the most propaganda is actually exhibited.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. That's it, you see. But it's awful. It means you have to kind of tread with trepidation through everything, you know. It's like, and again, like, I, as I said, I wouldn't mind if things were even-handed, if there was some kind of, if it wasn't all going in the same direction. But it's all going in the same direction.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like there's three letters I look out for as a major warning. It's anything to do with TV, and that's HBO. You know HBO?
Yeah.
It's an American. Now, if I see HBO, I say, all right, I'm not going there. I know instantly I'm not going there. I mean, if you just look at the programs that they make, everything is very, very much about a very ugly, nihilistic agenda.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
You have the concept, like I said, there's that dreadful program, The Sopranos, the ongoing Hollywood defamation of the Italian people. The people who brought you the Renaissance, the people who brought you all this wonderful art. Hollywood, how does it portray them as these kind of like these gorillas, these thugs in suits, you know, going around like, fuck you, you know, it's like everything. And it's like that. And then you have this like kind of like ridiculous kind of like nonsense, like kind of like, I don't know, there's some kind of sword and sorcery, Game of Thrones or Sitting on the Throne or whatever the hell it's called.
People love that, by the way. It's so popular. It's incredible.
I know they do. Yeah. But, you know, give people cleverly, wishily written lines, special effects, good-looking bodies, lots of sex and violence. And, you know, the urge part will take over. But it's like, you know, I'm not kind of like condemning that in itself, but it's towards ultimately the end game of debasing the human spirit.
And I've noticed too that there's a subversion definitely of sexuality going on within these series, and it's something, and I want people to just observe this if you watch it and just try begin to make note of it and see how it's changing as well. I mean, Boardwalk Empire, for example, I think that's another HBO one. You had this weird mom and son kind of sexuality going on. Even Game of Thrones had this also a very strange scene where a mom is weaning, if you will, a child who is, in approaching the teenage years and stuff like that. Very much of this stuff is going on. And I've noticed that it creeps in more and more. So I've made it my task to start observing it for the purpose of aiding people to, you know, in their education or at least looking at some of these stuff. So I do tend to note it and like, you know, take note and pin it down so I understand what's going on here. But it's definitely on the rise. It's very interesting.
Oh, definitely, yeah. And they're pushing the envelope. I mean, I saw that there's a picture of, it's some, I can't remember the name of it, some HBO garbage. And there's a little girl, and she's got some drinks container, and it's an erect penis.
Yeah.
So there's this little girl with this thing against her mouth. I mean, I'm talking a little girl, like about like 9 or something like
sure,
that.
Sure, sure.
You know? I mean, this is evil. You know,
yeah.
But of course, you see, people are very, very reluctant to criticize it because another thing as well, you see, it's kind of tough in a way because we've had essentially 50 or 60 years where the predominant kind of tenor of popular culture has been hedonism and kind of like say. Whatever, I'm just going to do it because it feels good and what have you, you know. No, don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm no Puritan in terms of like kind of like my own kind of like pleasures and things like that. But at the same time, there are consequences with these things. But a lot of the problem is that I think with like say people who are, you know, my age and a bit older is that there's a reluctance to criticize this stuff because we don't want to appear as hypocrites. But the difference is that when we were in our teens and when we were kind of like experimenting and things like that, there was an alternative culture we could compare it to.
There was a
more staid, more kind of like, say, for want of a better term, morally uptight culture we could compare it to. So there was a clear distinction. And not only that, we were doing it in an age before kind of like mobile phones could film things and thus they were on the internet for the rest of your life. And there's something I think particularly horrible and morbid about this, that you have a lot of these TV shows like kind of like, say, filming kids and young adults on holidays kind of getting up to all manner of kind of like behavior. That's it, they're stuck with that for the rest of their lives. And I think that this is really, really hard because a lot of this is just youthful experimentation and just kind of like letting rip. We all make mistakes and we all kind of overdo things. But the difference is like kind of like when I was doing it, it wasn't being filmed. At least I hope it wasn't being filmed. You know, but this is the kind of like the problem that we're living in. It's like a lot of people are reluctant to criticize this stuff.
Yeah, I know.
Because they're frightened of being considered hypocrites. But it's beyond things like that now. We can't worry about things like that. What this comes down to is we're up to our necks in the sewage. At what point do we say enough?
Yeah.
And also, as well, it's fine for those of us who've kind of like have had like sort of 20 odd years of adulthood. But what about kids?
Yeah. Well, exactly. You know, that's just the point, because, you know, you as a child, as a you know, teenager also, of course, as a you're hardwired to observe your surrounding to be able to fit in. You know, that is that is the properties that we hold. We're trying to understand where are the boundaries, what's normal, what's, you know, and then you try to aspire towards that. That's why people want to become popular when they're young, etc. Right. They want to try to fit in, right? So if that is skewed and, if you will, perverted, then it's something that's going to change these kids and teenagers forever, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, like, you know, I shudder to think of, like, kind of the changing sexual mores through internet pornography. Because the difference is, of course, like, kind of like when I was a schoolboy, and if there was a kind of a girly mag, it would be a picture of a naked woman. Yeah?
Yeah.
Whereas everything you can imagine and a lot of stuff you can't imagine and wouldn't want to imagine, it's all like 2 clicks away, 3 clicks away. You know, and when your sexuality is developing, this is incredibly destructive. But I mean, this is, of course, as well by design. And another thing I think about is your consciousness is there. And where is precisely is it your consciousness is going when you're watching this kind of thing or immersed in this kind of thing?
Yeah, I know.
And the long-term effects this will have on the next generation. You know, but this is deliberate as well, because I think that the end game is to absolutely destroy sexuality and sexual attraction.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you see, after a while, you become so saturated where nothing works anymore. You know, this is I mean, if you think of, like, say, I mentioned the Marquis de Sade earlier on. The Marquis de Sade, in order, I mean, I once read, I could be wrong, but in order to kind of get off, he had to be sodomized, was whipping a woman. You know, that is not, I don't know, to me, that really isn't a kind of a model to follow. That's not really where I think we should be going.
No, well, exactly. I mean, again, TV series that shows, I think it's called autoerotic asphyxiation. It's basically when they strangle themselves while they're you know, having an orgasm and stuff like that. But again, Boardwalk Empire, Weeds, very subversive television show. And they showed it, it seems to me, when I saw this, that it was like they're trying to portray that like it's the cool thing. It's like the normal things that you do now kind of thing. You know?
Yeah, it's an in thing to do. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. You see, maybe it's because I'm of a different generation. I would think that like kind of, you wouldn't admit to doing something like that even if you did do it. It's just, kind of, you know, it's not something to actually be kind of like proud of.
Right.
You know,
right.
But I mean, it's again, it's kind of like, you know, we have to make some kind of a stand, because this isn't about us. This isn't about those of us who actually had a kind of an alternative culture that we could fall back upon. Because after all, I mean, that's what kind of those of us who are like in our late 30s and 40s and 50s, we could have like fallen back on a more kind of, for want of a better term, a more sort of a less letting it all hang out culture.
Yeah.
Whereas kids these days, well, what can they fall back? And you see, because everything is nihilistic and everything is almost pornographic.
Yeah.
You know, there's actually very, very little place for them to go, you know, and their parents, you see, who are like kind of like probably baby boomers, are then reluctant to kind of say anything because they knew they got up to naughtiness themselves and they don't want to appear hypocritical, or more importantly, they don't want to appear uncool.
Exactly.
They're concerned with not being the parent, but with being their kid's friend.
Exactly. They want to be the buddy, you know.
Well, because I'm still cool because 60 is the new 30, or you know, some such nonsense, you know. But
exactly.
I mean, it's difficult. It's very, very difficult to step outside these things. And I know it's very easy to sound. I know sometimes I can kind of hear myself, and I think, God, I'm terribly judgmental, and I don't mean to be, because it's. I know it's very, very. It's very, very hard to fall into these things. It's very, very hard to question the pattern that you're locked into. It's very, very hard to question. It's very hard to question your own appetite and your own modes of behavior. You know, it's only when you're kind of shocked out of these things and appalled by it, or when it reaches a tipping point and you say, you know what, this can't get better.
Yeah, and again, Gavin, I mean, it's what you said. You said you don't engage in it anymore, that meaning you're taking a break from it, so that when you do encounter it again, then it's such a shock. You're like, wow, what the hell happened here? You know, it's
how quickly did this go? Yeah.
And it's an insane world, and you have to begin to point out these things to balance some of the stuff, because it could just go down the drain, you know?
Yeah, well, this is it. I mean, the thing is, like, you know, I mean, because I didn't watch that Smiley Virus thing with her twerking or whatever, but I'm not going to go there, like, but when I saw some picture, and it kind of struck me, you know, you know, this is family entertainment. And it's this one with her arse in the air and this guy, you know, rubbing his groin up against her arse.
Yeah.
You know, that's family entertainment.
Yeah, exactly. Like, all good. Is, no problem. You know, it's all fine.
Yeah, this is like, I mean, this is, I mean, I don't know. You know, it's, well, this is the whole point. See, there's no alternative to that culture. There's nothing for you to fall back on. There's nothing, I'm talking about in popular culture, yeah? There's
right.
no alternative. You have to basically kind of, you have to kind of withdraw from it entirely. You know, I don't really know what other people can do. You see, in a way, it's easier for me because I'm an artist myself and a musician myself, and because I grew up in a time when there was an alternative to that. And already I've heard so much music, I probably don't, you know, I don't know if I'll ever have the time to actually listen to as much because I've been intensely listening to music and looking at paintings and stuff all my life, you know. But I mean, if you're a kid, well, what the hell do you do? And this is where basically it comes down to us to essentially to be, dare I say it, a little bit adult about things and say, well, you know, hang on, we have a duty to not only protect the coming generation, but also to protect art and culture. Because when we die, when we go, what do we leave? Because if you're to talk about, like, say, I don't know, kind of, I don't know, say Rembrandt or Manet or something like that, you can read into the paintings the context of the time. But the context is over, they're dead, that's all gone. But the content remains, the painting remains. And that's what we used to call, like, say, a tradition. That's what all peoples throughout the world have, traditions. And what it is, it's a legacy, it's bequeathed to the next generation, so they have something. But that comes with a responsibility. It isn't just ours to trivialize, it's ours to venerate and to protect. And we should look at art and culture, all art and all culture, in the same way that we should perhaps look upon children, that we protect them, that we have a duty to protect them, that we have a duty to provide a kind of a healthy, loving, beautiful environment for them.
Yeah, and there's such a hatred towards human beings as well. I mean, look at how humans are portrayed in, you know, in the kids' movies, the Disney movies and everything else. There's like this, and everything has become about, I mean, it's important what you say about, you know, what do we leave after us?
A
couple of thousand years ago, people, they chiseled in stone, you know, they left these monuments that stand for thousands and thousands of years. Today, we're like, we use a spray bottle on the stone. It'll be rained away in 2 years' time. It's about making no footprint at all. I mean, even with the ideas of like the carbon footprint, we come into the earth as human beings, but we're not allowed to leave a mark or do anything or have an identity. It should be like when you look back historically on this paper, it will be, or on this period, it will be a blank paper pretty much. There'll be nothing there. Yeah,
there's nothing there, exactly, and it's typified by the art. Where the content doesn't exist. There is no content. You have a light going on and off, and you have people explaining what the significance of the light going on and off. But when those people, when that context is gone, what's left? It's nothing. But it's not passive non-art. It's active anti-art. This is designed to destroy. This is designed to destroy, because, like I said, this art doesn't sit alongside traditional craft-based art. This replaces it. It's to destroy it. This is quite deliberate. You know, and also as well, the idea that we leave something. It isn't just that we leave a mark, a part of ourselves, but we leave something for people, for the next generation who are coming along.
Yeah.
You know, but whereas everything, I think, for such a long time has been about destruction. And also as well, the sense of, like, impermanence, to keep people in flux, to keep people. So when all they have, when all they can follow is the corporate model or the state model, you can get them to do anything.
Yeah.
You can completely control them. And when basically their view of themselves is the lowest possible version, that essentially they're basically, they've got like a cheeseburger in one hand and their genitals in their other hand, you know, or something, you know, or, you know, they're jerking a joystick of some description in front of a screen, you know, that's all they are. They were just a collection of appetites, and they were these shameful creatures that are beneath contempt, that man is the kind of, I mean, you had that Prince Philip,
The virus.
Oh yeah. He wants to come back as a virus, you know. And he already is a virus. He doesn't need to come back. Him and his entire hideous lion are a bloody virus. there are a pox on humanity. They're already here, Philip.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, good
point. It's absolutely horrible. But essentially, it's too late in the game for us to actually do nothing about it. And no, I don't know, because everyone has their own way of going about resistance.
Sure, and it shouldn't be. That is a step that shouldn't be homogenized and even organized, because otherwise it'll be taken over, it will be hijacked, all other things.
It's like everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It has to be, broken up into smaller cells and just go at it, live your dreams, spread the joy and create beauty, Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And the thing is, because we are not machines, we are infinite beings, we're infinite in our imaginations, in our tenderness, in our compassion, in our silliness, in our playfulness, and in our capacity for joy and beauty and to care for each other, regardless of self-interest.
Yeah.
And we all have very, very different ways of going about doing things. So you're absolutely right, because if there was one homogenized way, it would be co-opted like everything else. But also as well, you see, this is the whole problem, the whole idea of imposing a one-size-fits-all model upon humanity.
Yeah.
That's been the blight upon humanity since the dawn of time.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask about something else here, and we'll begin to round up here in a little while, but the identification of the dark side. I think you talked about this a little bit in one of your videos as well, that the hero is now the evil, dark individual. It's the confusion that it turns out that the bad guy was really the good guy, right? And
it approaches us
towards this kind of moral relativism, etc. From a philosophical point of view, of course, it's great to question the immediate perception of self-righteousness, of saying, okay, wait a minute, let me look at the whole picture. Am I completely right here, etc.? But this is about confusing these things, it feels like to me.
Definitely.
Black becomes white, white has become, black, etc., right?
Absolutely. And where, essentially, the actions don't count because you're always questioning the motive. I mean, I mentioned, Batman, who's been recast as the Dark Knight. I mean, which troubles me for many reasons. One, because this is innocuous children's entertainment. It's for kids. It's this good guy just going around fighting bad guys. It's harmless. It's completely just for kids. But because we live in this adolescent culture, we don't leave children's culture alone. We take it with us. We don't make the transit into a more reflective culture. So what we do is we overload it with our own nihilism and our own kind of adolescent preoccupations. But of course, the Dark Knight, Batman, I think that the reasoning is like that. He fights crime, not because he wants to do the right thing, but because he himself, his parents were killed by criminals or something. So his motive, the motivation, is kind of coming from a vengeful, wrathful place. It's also coming from so he himself can be, he's not going to just fight crime, he's not just going to do the good thing, he can be the bad guy as well. And you have this whole thing, the cult of the anti-hero, which is so tedious now,
Yeah.
I remember seeing on a bus an advert for, I didn't see the film, Captain America, a recent version of Captain America. And I thought, oh, here we go. I don't need to see the film. I've seen the advert. And the advert, it isn't the guy with his mask on. It's this guy, this sullen kind of troubled expression, Captain America. So obviously, he's not just a guy, healthy, kind of good guy out there fighting crime. No, he's some troubled, dark, kind of complex, and it's not as easy as that. But this is it, you see, it's because then you're into that whole world of moral relativism. And you see, what that does is, you see, that has a knock-on effect. That means you question your own motives. Even when you are doing something selfless, you doubt it. And this, you see, this ties in as well, you see, with the whole kind of, the control of language through, political correctness, where you're made to feel that, left to your own devices, you will say horrible stuff. this is ridiculous, Most people aren't. Most people aren't racist bigots. Most people aren't. Most people, and if they are, they have the common sense not to speak like that. But it's this idea that you have people who are fundamentally decent tripping themselves up because they don't know what the correct phraseology is for it. I mean, I remember the first time I saw the term BLGTB community, and I thought, what the hell is the LG? I thought it was like BLT, which is a bacon lettuce sandwich, I thought, what's the LGT? And that's the lesbian, gay, transsexual, bisexual community. And because you can't say gay, you can't say homosexual, lesbian, you know. No, it's the LGTB, a community, what, are they all living together or something? I mean, this is ridiculous. This is just ludicrous. But of course, yeah, that's a mind trick because you laugh at it, but at the same time, you might be just about to say gay or homosexual, but you might stop yourself because, oh no, hang on, what are they called? No, they're
I can't say that. Yeah, exactly. You're not.
Yeah,
yeah,
I can say that. You know, like, you know, I mean, this is just ridiculous. But what it actually does is it puts a space between you and your expression. So you're having to question everything before you're having to question everything you say, everything you think.
Yeah.
You doubt yourself. You doubt as well your morality. You doubt that you're good, because also as well, you see, that's a little bit like the whole world. I don't know if it's as bad in Sweden as it is here with health and safety.
Oh God, just don't get me started on that, guys. Oh God.
Yeah,
oh,
health
Jesus.
And safety. It's like kind of like, you know, don't do this, don't do that, blah blah blah. I mean, just ridiculous, you know. I it's funny actually. I was in Helsinki about 9 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and it was wonderful. I was in Lahtisaari, that little island near Helsinki, and they had all these caves there, and they just had this little sign saying, kind of like, you know, be careful when going through the caves. And I said, oh, brilliant, the caves, they're not cordoned off. And I went in and promptly slipped and fell on my butt. Because I'm used to health and safety. I'm used to not being allowed to go places where I might hurt myself.
That's funny, yeah. Well, they're better off than we are than in Helsinki, because in Sweden it's absolutely horrendous. I think the focus, again, on we brought this up in other programs, but it very much ties into what we've been talking about here today, that the overall management of the human being,
yeah,
where we're no
right.
longer left to our own devices to discover things on our own, to hurt ourselves, actually, even so that we can learn from these mistakes, is ultimately what's going to make us stupid and weak. Yeah. And we're not going to be able to, you know, take care of anything in the future, which is, of course, the point of all of this, to socially manage and you know, control mankind.
Yeah, exactly. This is it, you see, because the environment becomes, everything becomes threatening to you, everything becomes frightening, and everything becomes worrying. I mean, it's a little, like when I was a kid, you could still go out and climb trees, you know?
Yeah.
So you're able to gauge, then I might hurt myself here, you know? It's like, you know, but also you're closer to the natural world then. You're more alike, which I think, it's one of the reasons I think that we have such an interest in say, nature sprites, earth elementals, you know, and fairies and things, because I think that they offer a mediating presence between the world of us, of men, and the world of nature. These beings that are like us, but they're closer to nature. And I think that that's why, kind of like, say, the idea of, say, Peter Pan or Pan, this figure, is very, very appealing to us culturally, because we relate, we're excited by that idea of being kind of like closer to nature and not troubled by things, but not at a distance from nature. But of course, the whole health and safety thing is telling you that everything is dangerous. Everything is a threat. Trust the experts. No, no, no.
Yeah.
Let the experts step in. Let the experts tell you how to do things, how to, you know, because you're not capable of doing this. This is for your own good. And I mean, I don't know if it's as bad. I'm sure it probably is, actually, as you have over here, this horrible, horrible state of child stealing by the state.
Oh yeah, definitely. Same here. Same here.
Yeah. I absolutely appalling. These state representatives just barging in. Just, I mean, there's footage on, horrible footage. It's probably been taken down from YouTube, of like social workers and the police taking a 1 day old baby from their parents. I mean, this is absolutely horrible. But they can get away with that. And you have scare stories every now and then. You'll have these appalling stories in the press, just to show, well, we need to have, you know, people can't be left to their own devices.
Exactly.
People can't be trusted.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, like, say, for every kind of appalling case, like where children are, that most people don't do that. Most people don't behave like that.
No, of course not.
But at the same time, you see what you have, you see, because with the whole health and safety mentality, what that does, the same as like with the whole kind of, we're all a little bit like the Marquis de Sade, that's as well to kind of normalize a very, very horrendous kind of inhuman view of humanity.
Yeah.
You know, like, say, the whole kind of, like, say, push towards kind of viewing, say, pedophilia as a sexual orientation. I mean, I don't know if it's how far along that might be in Sweden, but there's a lot of talk of it now that they want to reclassify pedophilia as an orientation, like, say, being gay or something like that, rather than being a rapist, which is what they are.
Yeah.
You know, because there's the whole power thing coming into it, like an adult with a child. You know, that it's you know, this is like saying, well, it's a rapist, that's their sexual orientation. I'm sorry, I can't help it. I have to rape women because that's my orientation. I don't have moral choice.
Yeah.
I am not responsible for my actions because of my appetite.
Yeah. Well, again, it's just that, again, it's the removal of the basic organism within, you know, our body that makes these decisions and everything else. That you when the more and more you kind of peel away at that, the more less human we're going to be. But at the same time, it's also about punishing those who are actually capable people, who are living in a very just and moral way, and are good people. Because again, it says you're guilty until proven innocent kind of attitude right now, and it means that we have a few rotten eggs within society. But now we all have to live guilty. And abide by those rules because we had a few assholes there. I mean, this is doing such an immense disservice, and the focus, therefore, on the safety and the security of everyone else is at the expense of everyone else's freedom, which is so bad and terrible, you know?
Well, this is it, you see. And I mean, you have things now, like sort of if your child is at a sports day like that, you can't photograph them in case you're a paedophile photographing children.
Yeah.
I mean, this is insane.
Yeah.
This is actually, it's not. It's actually very calculated. It's to normalize that view. That view is like say that actually will kind of like a lot more people than, you know, a lot more people than you think actually are paedophiles. And then when you say, well, you know, maybe if a significant amount of these people are paedophiles, well, maybe it's not such a bad thing after all, you know, because it's all the same kind of process. It's essentially turning everything on its head, turning absolutely everything on its head. You know, so if you are if you are a moral person, that is, if you're trying to not hurt people, if you're trying to kind of say live by your kind of like say standards that don't hurt other people, and you want that, you want to be able to be left alone to get on with your life, there's something wrong with that.
Yeah,
and you're
exactly.
made to doubt that. You're made to doubt that.
Yeah,
yeah. And it's but this is all by design.
There's something wrong with you. We just haven't found it yet.
See, oh yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah. This is it. We're back in the world of the authoritarian personality, the authoritarian personality disorder.
Yeah,
as Adorno wrote about. You know, this is it. You know, everything's a mental illness. Everyone is suffering from neurosis of some kind. You know, you know that used to be just called being human. You know, and it led to all of this. You know, wonderful. It led to the flowers of human consciousness, philosophy, and art, and as our ways of exploring our human nature.
Yeah,
not knocking them out, not destroying it.
Yeah, you're right. It's of course discouraging to such a large extent here. But what, as a way to round things up a little bit, some of the thoughts if we project forward. Of course, you mentioned the Caligula type possibility here in the future. But what
I think it's here already.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the only way that you see, of course, as you said, then begin to fight, if you will, against this, have some kind of resistance, is to simply begin to lead by example and spreading things into the world that we think are good in that regard and beautiful,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, never ever underestimate the effect you can have as an individual. I mean, think of it like sort of you know, one asshole can make your life terrible if he smacks a bottle in your head, you know. But at the same time, if you're having a bad day. And if somebody just comes up to you and says, "Are you okay?" and touches you on the shoulder, that can make all the difference. People do that. We have an effect. We have an influence, and we can do. We have a lot more power than we give ourselves credit for. And I'm talking about real power, not the rubbish having power over people, which is pointless.
Sure.
That's not power at all.
No.
But I mean, to the extent that we can influence things. We can actually do a lot more than we give ourselves credit for. But I mean, the wonderful thing about the age we're living in is that people are, more and more people are now thinking, because of necessity being the mother of invention, because we're being attacked from all sides, we're having to become more resourceful, we're having to become more reflective, and we're having to actually, embrace and kind of our potential a lot more than perhaps we were before. Because, I mean, time was, I mean, like, say, you know, like say 40, 50 years ago, you would have been able to get a job and get a mortgage and keep your head down and tick along. And that just isn't an option anymore. But because it's not an option anymore, it means that we have an opportunity to really, really kind of increase the greater and more beautiful aspects of our humanity.
Very good. Very well said, Gavin. I think we should begin to round things up here for this time. I wanted to give out some of the websites here again. Of course, easy ways to search. Sand Snowman, you can search on Facebook at bandcamp.com. And then you have sandsnowmanpaintings.blogspot.co.uk. We'll have some of these links up there. But what are you working on right now?
There's a Bandcamp with Sand Snowman and Moonswift and Sand Snowman. That's with my wife and long-term musical partner. We just did an album earlier this year.
Oh, interesting. Right.
Yeah.
we'll have that link up as well for people. Are you working on something new right now, Gavin? What's in the works, the plan?
Oh, I'm actually working on about three different musical projects at the moment. And where myself and Moonswift are rehearsing with the guitarist, we've got a couple of low-key things going. There's a couple of things I'm not going to talk about in case Tempting Fate, in case they don't come to be, but there's a few, could be a few interesting shows we might be doing. And I'm just working on a few more paintings as well at the moment. But I'm just very, very much immersed in my work, which is kind of the best thing I think I can do, just try to just get on with doing what I do, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I definitely understand it. Well, thank you for your time today, Gavin. I really appreciate it. And, of course, thank you for contemplating the things that you do and for the encouraging and interesting discussion. Very good to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Henrik. It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, everybody, that's our program for today. I want to thank you for listening. We have some stellar programs coming up. One is with Jeeva Singh Anand and Joseph Vaigs on the actual translation of the entire Illuminati ritual. I mean, the real stuff here, the real Bavarian Illuminati. And they are currently working on a book. The working title is Ritual and Doctrine of the Illuminati. And we're going to discuss this. It's coming up here shortly. Then we have Louise Proud, Anthony Peake, John Whitehead, and many more coming on after that. My thanks to the Red Ice team, Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John. And a special thanks to you, as always, our beloved members. And we'll talk to you in just a few days. Until then, take care and be well.